Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. This is Norm Diamond, your host. Patricia Kullberg is our producer. We are already a week into spring. I hope you're enjoying the colors and the smells, the sounds, the warmth, the returns from migration, and general rebirth that come with this glorious season. It may seem anomalous to have our political program celebrate nature in that way. But today we also celebrate the birthday this month of the great revolutionary and naturalist Rosa Luxemburg. As we'll see, even in the darkest times, even in her jail cell, Luxemburg found sustenance in the songs of birds and the consolation in the shape of clouds. When she wasn't organizing conferences or writing pamphlets, she was studying botany, listening to music, or exploring the outdoors with friends. When her comrades despaired or felt exhausted by the struggle, she reminded them that our road is long and it's important to maintain ourselves as full human beings. It won't surprise you to learn that our music this morning is from a contemporary French progressive rock group that calls itself Rosa Luxemburg. Also on this morning's program, Bill Resnick talks with Emery Mort about Oregon's recently concluded legislative session. Mort is chief of staff for State Representative Teresa Alonso León, who represents House District 22, centered in Woodburn. You've heard Bill and Emery talk before on the Old Mole about the Black Lives Matter street protests in Portland. This time, they discuss the accomplishments and disappointments of the 2022 session and the larger questions of tactics and strategy around reforms. What is the role of legislative victories in bringing about significant social change? I have to warn you, Rosa Luxemburg would be skeptical. After Bill and Emery, Luisa Martinez brings us an April Fool's Day spoof. I'll have more to say about that in a bit. Then Matt Witt reviews two novels, Alibi Creek by Bev McGinnis and The Music of Bees by Eileen Garvin. Both novels explore the struggles of contemporary women in towns near us and the lessons these women learn about sources of support among friends, family, and community. Together with the aforementioned wisdom of Rosa Luxemburg, our theme for today's program, then, is where we can look for support and sustenance in hard times. This is my first show of the spring, and I'd like to do what I did for my first winter program. Pause just a bit to remember where we are in time. I've mentioned that one of my all-time favorite authors is Eduardo Galeano, an Uruguayan writer of anecdotes and parables. One of his last books before he died in 2015 was Los Hijos de los Días, Children of the Days, in which he highlighted a significant event in history specific to each date of the calendar. Here are three that intrigue me from this month. For March 14, he wrote, Capital. In 1883, a crowd gathered for Karl Marx's funeral in a London cemetery. A crowd of 11, counting the undertaker. The most famous of his sayings became his epitaph. The philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point, however, is to change it. This prophet of global change spent his life fleeing the police and his creditors. Regarding his masterwork, he said, "No one ever wrote so much about money while having so little. Capital will not even pay for the cigars I smoked writing it." I will add that you can still see that epitaph if you visit Marx's tomb in Highgate Cemetery. The other two readings I've selected, because we're still in Women's History Month. For March 3rd, Galeano wrote, "The Founding Mothers of Brazil." This day, in 1770, brought an end to the queendom of Teresa de Benguela in Quariterê. It was one of many sanctuaries of freedom for fugitive slaves in Brazil. For 20 years, Teresa had thwarted the soldiers of Mato Grosso's governor. They never did capture her alive. In these densely wooded hiding places, women did much more than cook and give birth. A number of them were fighters and leaders, like Zacim de Gambo in Espiritu Santo, Mariana Crioula in the hinterlands of Rio de Janeiro, Zeferina in Bahia, and Felipa Maria Arana in Tocantins. In Pará, on the banks of the Trombetas River, no one questioned orders given by May Domingas. In the vast refuge of Palmares in Alagoas, the African princess Akualtune governed a free town until it was torched by colonial troops in 1677. In Pernambuco, the community founded in 1802 by two fugitive black sisters, Francisca and Mendeja Ferreira, still exists. It is called Conceição dos Crioulos. Whenever the slave's troops drew near, the former slave women filled their frizzy African tresses with seeds. As elsewhere in the Americas, they turned their heads into granaries in case they had to flee at a moment's notice. And for March 7th, Galeano wrote about witches in a way that I've not seen before. Modern historians, mainly women, have made a wonderful contribution in overturning the simplistic fairy tale understandings of women charged as witches. We now know that the charges frequently came out of anxieties created by times of social upheaval, and frequently, too, were efforts to reduce the power of women as economic changes led to changes in social roles. Galeano's anecdote for the day of March 7th seems to have a lighter mood, until we remember this was a time of unsettled gender roles, and when they were burning at the stake, people charged with witchcraft. 7th of March, the witches. In the year 1770, the English Parliament debated a law to punish wily women. Perfidious females had been seducing His Majesty's subjects and tricking them into matrimony using such evil arts as scents, paints, cosmetic washes, artificial teeth, false hair, Spanish wool, I don't know what Spanish wool is, iron stays, hoops, high-heeled shoes, or bolstered hips. The authors of these frauds, the bill said, shall incur the penalty of the law in force against witchcraft and the like misdemeanors, and the marriage, upon conviction, shall stand null and void. The charges against Rosa Luxemburg weren't witchcraft, but often amounted to the same, an uppity woman stirring up trouble. The last time she was jailed, there weren't even charges. She was in protective custody, she was told, which also meant she wasn't eligible for release when amnesty was declared, because she hadn't been charged with anything to amnesty her from. Here's just a bit of music from the French group named after her, Rosa Luxemburg. As befitting their namesake, the music can be a bit raucous. Emery Mort participated in nearly all the Black Lives Matter protests that erupted in Portland after the police murder of George Floyd. He did interviews and produced a video record. He also came to the Old Mole and shared his perspective with Bill Resnick. Today they address a related topic, the response in the Oregon State Legislature, what bills were passed and what weren't, and in what ways is it worthwhile to participate in what Rosa Luxemburg called parliamentary cretinism. Emery Mort is chief of staff for State Representative Teresa Alonso León. Bill?
Emery Mort, welcome again to KABU.
Thank you, Bill. It's really nice to be here talking with you.
Last time Emery was on the Old Mole, you were the very model of a movement journalist, a street historian, covering all 9 months near daily at the beginning, but still major protests by Black Lives Matter. Emery Mort's detailed diary, his notes, blog, and video has been invaluable for anybody who wants to know what happened. After a period of decompression, Emery got a paying position as chief of staff for State Representative Teresa Alonso León, who specializes in immigration and education issues. Today we'll discuss Emery's experience in the 2022 Oregon legislative session, the trials and tribulations of being an Oregon legislator, and we'll also speculate on what sorts of reform are not just palliative to ease the pain, to help people through the country's broken economic and political systems with temporary palliatives, but we'll talk about reforms that show the way to that other, better, democratic, and sustainable world. First, Emery Mort, evaluate the short 2022 session, its accomplishments, and also the disappointments.
Thanks, Bill. I would say the 2022 legislative session, it's a short session in Oregon, you know, every other year is a short legislative session, which is like 5 weeks. And I would say most analysts and participants would say it was a very successful session in terms of quite a lot getting done. The aggressive Republican Party was not able to walk out and shut down the session. And there were many bills that were passed that, you know, it's hard to argue that they weren't at least really attempting in a sincere way to address the major crises going on in the state, from the pandemic, from just an economy and a society that's having a lot of trouble without much of a social net. So I guess in brief, some of the highlights were, you know, the Democrats managed to pass farmworker overtime policy in the state with the backing of just a huge coalition that pushed that across the finish line against intense opposition the entire time. And then there were bills trying to address things like the cost of childcare soaring. There's a bill to send out $600 checks to every Oregonian who earns the earned income tax credit. There's attempts to address serious workforce issues, behavioral health, healthcare, education, where you're having crises of staffing and all of that. And there was also a major change of leadership. Tina Kotek stepped down from her longtime speaker position in the House. Peter Courtney, the Speaker of the Senate, announced this would be his last time. So you had a change of leadership, which is a big deal for people who work in the legislature. But despite all of that, there was a lot of cheering and feeling like folks really worked their butt off and got a lot done, despite also some real glaring holes of things that didn't get done. For example, there's a public defender crisis right now going on in the state, and that wasn't addressed in the state budget, despite having a huge budget surplus to spend. And of course, there are just real problems ahead with lots of people being very housing insecure. There's attempts to address houselessness and get people off the streets, but it's arguable that, you know, a lot of people are going to be ending up on the streets if certain things don't go certain ways. So I'll pause there, but there's just a ton that happened. It's pretty remarkable. But as you said, it's easy to look at it and see a lot of patchwork being done on a kind of a tattered system. But it's also important not to get like too cynical about it all, in my opinion.
Yeah, one final one on my list was the stopping of pretext arrests for minor infractions. That is when the police just stop a car for having a light not working. And then they search the car and search the person and force them to either humiliate themselves or, in fact, risk really serious injury. I think that was the major gain of Black Lives Matter in this legislature. Am I wrong?
Limiting the police's ability to pull someone over for a broken taillight or some other minor infraction like that, that was part of the Transforming Justice bill that did pass, that folks tried to pass last year. I mean, it's definitely a part of the Black Lives Matter push for societal justice, you know, attempting to stop, like, if you're black, just getting, like, pulled over and harassed all the time by police in a way that white people aren't. And there are other really important components of that bill, too. And so that bill did pass, again, with Republican opposition. You know, Republican, there's a big thing in the state where hyping up this rise of crime and lack of safety, and the Democrats don't support the police, and so crime in the state is rising. You know, this is a big political line, and the Democrats did not cave on that particular issue, held strong, and actually passed the bill, which may make it a challenge for some people running in more purple districts and things like that. We'll see. But there were other important bills, you know, universal representation passed, which provides, it's kind of first in its kind legislation in the country, providing community embedded legal representation to undocumented people, basically immigrants who aren't citizens who often end up in court for different proceedings, but now they will actually have a lawyer who will be able to work with them and give them a sense of dignity through those proceedings. So that passed as well. But I would maybe say Senator Lauren Spence, who folks may know, she helped pass a massive $50 million investment into Black and Indigenous and people of color communities. So that was another major bill that passed as part of the sort of Black Lives Matter movement in terms of, like, rectifying disinvestment and lack of investment is, like, getting state investment right into people's hands so that the Black community can economically prosper in a better way. I'm not an expert on that bill, and I might have said one or two things wrong, but I just know, like, that was a really good bill that I think Senator Lauren Spence was spearheading through the Senate.
Yeah, there was a good deal of disappointment also. It's the Black Lives Matter agenda was particularly with regard to the replacement of police by people who are far more qualified and successful in dealing with the homeless and with addiction.
Like Portland Street Response in Portland, or counselors and support in schools rather than officers and things like that.
The legislature did not touch that, nor did they touch, my sense is, police discipline, which is such a major thing in Portland, and it's governed by state law. So at least the city says their hands are tied. State law forces a kind of arbitration that the police always win for a variety of reasons when the city pushes more discipline. That seems to me a major loss.
Well, I would say, you know, and this is important to keep in mind, is that, I mean, Oregon's one of the most dynamic states in the country politically in a lot of ways. So on the policing discipline and policy side, I would argue that the state of Oregon and the city of Portland did actually manage to accomplish quite a lot. And that's part of how I got really interested in the Oregon legislature is last year watching and participating as Rep. Bynum led committees that were honing police reform packages, of which about 22 statutes managed to pass. And some of those do influence Portland, do influence that arbitration process. And so those can get a bit wonky, all those policies. But obviously, when it comes to policing, like, police has a lot of political power, and it takes a lot to go up against them and really get significant policy changes. But I would argue that Portland and the state of Oregon and the legislature actually have done quite a lot. It's not enough, but I think folks should feel like this is a state where it's possible to do a lot in that realm, in the realm of police reform or abolitionist type reforms even. And I think even this week, Portland Street Response is set to scale up to citywide, which is, you know, diverting, like, quite a lot of calls and contact between police and, you know, let's say vulnerable people or whatever. So I would say some of that is actually good. And I would say the Oregon legislature led by, you know, Black legislators like Rep. Bynum actually, like, stepped up and got a good deal done in that way. But there are other things that, like, if one talks with Black organizers in Portland or something, there's a lot of sense of a lot of things haven't gotten done, or a lot of promises that were made early on in the Black Lives Matter movement, like, weren't delivered upon by the legislature. So I'm not trying to paint, like, a rosy picture, but I'm just trying to say from the inside, I do think some things have been done, and then some promises or some energies kind of, like, faded. So some examples would be, like, Rep. Alonso León was pushing to get ethnic studies funding for professional development in Oregon schools, because Oregon passed a law saying, you know, like all students should have ethnic studies like embedded into their curriculum so that they see themselves and their own experience in the curriculum that they're learning in school. But the funding to do the professional development for that, which they're mandated to do that by 2026, so in a couple of years, but the funding just has just kept slipping through the cracks. And that seemed to happen again this year where, oh, we couldn't find the money to fund this ethnic studies program, which is part of Black Lives Matter. It's like teaching all of our history and embedding all that history in our school experience for our kids. Another one is the Racial Justice Youth Collaborative, which is going to be a one of its kind in the country, statewide collaborative of youth who meet and talk and organize around racial and social justice in their schools and actually have, like, because youth can be and are very powerful voices for social change and societal change, and they're often like not at the table when policies are being changed. And that policy didn't pass this year, and folks are definitely upset about, a lot of folks are really upset about that. So yeah, it's important, like a lot of policy did pass and some policy doesn't pass. And we could talk about like how all those power structures work and stuff within the legislature. And I'm still getting to know it, but it's very interesting.
Yeah, a few weeks ago, we were talking. I asked you what it's like for you to have to be up to speed on all the policy issues that come to the legislature. And that's also true for the whole legislature, all representatives. And it's especially tough for legislators when it is a part-time job paying $30,000 a year. No think tank or policy group would dream of asking its very highly educated staff, most people, to be able to have expertise in every issue that comes up. How do individual legislators like Teresa, Alonzo, Leon, how do they make decisions with regard to all of these issues that come before them?
Yeah, absolutely. So folks might have seen some articles and headlines recently about how a number of women legislators from the Democrat side who are chairs of committees, like chair of the House, you know, healthcare committee, you know, folks can imagine like how complex and advanced of a job that is. Well, they're stepping down. They're not coming back to the legislature. Maybe they've been there 4, 5, 6 years. And part of that is because they're paid like $32,000 a year to be legislators. That's what the statute says in Oregon. And if you listen to like Republicans and stuff, well, they'll say that, you know, they've always envisioned that they want the legislature to be like they don't want legislators to be full time. You know, they want them to be regular people, and legislation is just a part time thing that you do. But, you know, in reality, especially for women, Democrats who are, you know, Black folks, Indigenous folks, people from immigrant communities, they're in there really, really, really trying to do intense and deep policy change. And like you're saying, they have to be, and they become quite quickly, very expert in what they're doing. They have to understand a lot of complex systems. Otherwise, they can't move policy. And they're being paid, you know, $32,000 a year to do, yeah, a highly professional work that's really not just part-time, not just full-time, probably like more than full-time in a lot of cases. And in the legislature, I read a fellow staffer in the legislature posted that, he heard that in California, state legislators have like 10 staff, like their budget for each office allows them to have like 10 staff. And that is not the case in the Oregon legislature. Like basically each office maybe has one, maybe two full-time staff. And then they bring in some like staff just for the legislative session when things get really busy. All that to say, like it's a lot that's thrown on folks who are trying to, you know, fix just systems that are so maybe dilapidated, like Oregon's mental health system, or, you know, having a system that has justice for immigrants, poor people, Black people. Like there's just a huge amount of repair that needs to be done, or rebuilding, or constructing something anew. So how knowledge, there's knowledge of the policy itself, but then there's also the knowledge of like how the legislature works, like how decisions get made, or how, when push comes to shove, like what gets funded or what gets a hearing, what bill gets a hearing, and what bill is just left to die waiting in a committee. And a lot of that knowledge is kind of like passed down orally, like through story and through knowing someone face to face. And so here I am, I come into the legislature, for example, and I'm working remote. You know, normally everyone's in the Capitol, lobbyists are there talking to folks. Hey, can I tell you a little bit about this bill? And they'll show them a one pager, and kind of a lobbyist can be, in a good and bad way, be very expert at just like getting the key information into like a 1 or 2 minute or 5 minute discussion with a legislator or a staffer. And during these last couple of years, legislating has been more done at a distance or remote, over Zoom versus, or over the phone versus face to face. But yeah, to your original question of how expertise, you know, there's like advocate groups. There's people either in industry or in advocacy or even in a lot of the institutional knowledge can, especially when there's a lot of turnover in the legislature, can end up, the institutional knowledge can be in like staff or lobbyists or stuff because maybe they've been around 10 or 15, 20 years. Cause they are getting paid a salary that allows them to like buy a house eventually and have a family. So they become people who have a lot of institutional knowledge, which is a problem. And there was a bill this year to raise legislators' salaries, but that bill died for political reasons. It was hard to bring it to the public this year and be like, hey, you're all struggling, but we're going to give ourselves a raise. We're going to vote to give ourselves a raise. Even though that would almost certainly like help the state a lot, it was a hard sell to actual voters who don't take kindly in a sort of like reactive way, to knee-jerk way to that kind of thing. So I'll pause there. I know that was a lot, but those are some of my observations.
Yeah, this notion of citizen legislators in a part-time, just ordinary people. In fact, my sense is because it's so poorly paid and people have to have second jobs or third jobs. In fact, many of the legislators are lawyers who use their position to befriend the various businesses in their area. And they're really not as interested in policy as they are in securing favors from the businesses that are most powerful in their area. It seems to me it's a real problem having a lot of people who cannot live, or you can't raise a family on $32,000. And so you're always caught between your day job and then the legislation.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. This is Bill Resnick for KABU, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM, talking to Emory Moore, street historian, who went to near every action of the Black Lives Matter, George Floyd protests in town. His notes and video are invaluable for anyone who wants to know what happened. Having lobbied and testified before the legislature, he was hired as chief of staff to Teresa Alonzo Leon, who led the charge to successfully defeat the farmers' lobby, who don't lose often in the state legislature. Probably only the timber industries are more successful, putting off very needed legislation. The bill that she won was required farmers to pay overtime to farm workers. Very significant victory, actually. Will surely increase since in harvest times, 10, 12, 14-hour days are very frequent. It will surely increase worker income. How did it come about? What were the factors that allowed that bill to pass?
First of all, you know, Rep. Alonso Leon came here from the state of Michoacán in Mexico with her parents when she was 4, and her parents still work in Oregon farms and have worked in Oregon farms for over 40 years. And her district is like the center of Latino farm workers and indigenous farm workers in the state of Oregon, down north of Salem and Woodburn, Jervis. So passing farm worker overtime this session was a big win for her community. And that bill, I'm not an expert in that bill's whole process, but I will give a quick summary from what I feel like I understand. First of all, a few other states have passed farm worker overtime bills in the last few years. They all involve a kind of phase-in period to try to like not hurt various levels of agriculture industry too much, allow them to kind of, you know, basically phase it in. And Oregon's no different. So basically like a bipartisan, bicameral, both houses, the Senate and the House, had a kind of like long task force sort of thing where everyone was kind of sitting down, negotiating, listening to advocates, kind of trying to hammer out a bill that does it right so that you have like justice for workers and a bill that like doesn't harm and doesn't mean to harm the agriculture industry in the state. And that was led by Paul Holvey in the House. And actually for our office, for Rep. Alonso Leon's office, she's the chair of the education committee. So she's like deeply connected with the farm worker organizing organizations who she's worked with for years, getting her into office, doing policy, But in this very short session, she was really focused, I would say, on like education bills. And she's also in the healthcare committee and some other bills. So it wasn't like our office every day was the spearhead on the farm worker overtime bill, even though she's very like personally connected to that. To that policy.
What about the movements? That bill was in play for a number of legislatures. It's been a long time coming. My sense was that, in fact, the movements, you know, on the left, we point out all the time the way to win things is to, you know, generate movements that politicians can't resist. What do you see as the role of the movements in the farm worker overtime bill?
Well, I mean, I think the movement strength of PICUN and other core organizations that were driving this, I mean, I think they did an incredible job. And one key is that they had a lot of other unions and organizations like brought on board, and they had commitments from them that when push came to shove, when the rubber hit the road, when the Republicans and industry like really turned up the heat against this policy, that when that happened, that these other groups were going to call on their members to actually take action to support the passage of this bill, to support the Democrats staying strong and passing it, to support them and say, if you vote yes on this, if you guys don't back down, like, we'll still have your back come the next election time. Or if the Republicans threaten to walk out and shut down the whole session over farm worker overtime, like, we're not having that. Or we will, you know, we will step out and say something to try to push back on that. And I think the hearings, there were just hours and hours and hours of hearings where you'd have both sides turning out tons of people to testify. You know, you'd have like small blueberry farmers saying, you know, this is going to destroy us and we treat our people well and this law is terrible. No one's listening to us, you know. And there were three times as many people calling up and making the argument that like every other industry deals with times when folks have to work more than usual. And this is what this overtime protection is there for. But definitely, I think the passage of this was riding on the coattails of successes that movements have had in other states, New York, California, Washington, and other states, and also riding on the racial justice movement. That's just like, you heard that argument time and again, that like the lack of farm worker overtime is a racist policy and we've got to correct this injustice. And they successfully did pass that law this year, despite nonstop opposition and grandstanding of different forms.
This is Bill Resnick talking to Emory Moore, the chief of staff of Representative Teresa Alonzo Leon, about the 2022 session of the Oregon legislature. It passed a great deal of legislation that served working people and also particularly its lowest income people. We discussed how movements can win and how to build power. Emory Moore, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks, Bill. I really appreciate it.
That was Bill Resnick and Emory Moore evaluating the recently concluded Oregon legislative session. And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. You've heard Luisa Martinez as the Old Mole's intrepid foreign correspondent, with reports from places as far afield as Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Brazil. In some of her travels, Luisa apparently goes by hovercraft yacht. Here, straight from the stateroom of an exclusive shipboard gathering of U.S. oligarchs, you have to wonder how Luisa gained access, she reproduces a drug-fueled rant she overheard by one of the kleptocrats. The language is so raw that you have to be at least 21 to continue listening. These are the megalomaniacs running our society. What'd this guy sound like, Luisa?
When I became an executive of a company that produces mason jars back in 2003, I never dreamed my life was going to be like this. A decade ago, we were just another glassware business. But now, there's not a precious little bar in New York, LA, or anywhere else that isn't serving drinks out of our iconic containers. And now that mason jars are on top, now that my fellow executives and I are beverage conquistadors, we're going to enjoy this cocaine-fueled rocket ride for as long as it lasts. I'm blasting off to Mars, and I'm headed straight through the belly of the sun. As long as every gastropub and Williamsburg speakeasy wants to keep pouring craft cocktails into our jars, We're going to swim in Peruvian street spice and party like savages. You keep mounting mason jars by your bathroom sinks and using them as toothbrush holders? We'll keep buying Fabergé eggs faster than Sotheby's auctioneers can shit them out. You make mason jars into jack-o'-lanterns. We wear tie pins that could put a kid through college. You don't think I'm a bona fide golden king? I'm on a hovercraft right now. That's what that sweet craft and green will get you. That and world-class trim at every nightclub VIP room on Earth. Seriously, it's like my mansion magically grows a new Italianate fountain every time someone fills our jars with seashells and uses them as decorative centerpieces. I have 8 infinity pools. Look, I never expected any of this from mason jars. Who would? You don't get a 600-foot mega yacht and not give an ever-loving f*** if you sink at all, if all you've got bankrolling you are little old ladies canning strawberry preserves. But the way that these babies are selling, there's no limit to what my colleagues and I could get away with. We're better than men, better than gods. We're jar-powered god slaughterers. I haven't slept in 5 days, and I don't give a shit. I don't even remember buying this cheetah. Do you know what I can do? I can walk into any bed and breakfast in America and just take my out right in front of everybody. And no one's going to say to me, because they know that without me, those mason jar light fixtures with a bulb strung through the lid wouldn't exist. They know that I gave them that nice little rustic touch. Me, I did it. I did that. So my room better be ready, and there better be a kilo of Vermont's finest crystal in my pillow too, because if there isn't, I'm taking every one of my jars out to my Bugatti with me, and you can explain to your guests why your flowers are stuffed in a boring ceramic vase that makes them want to blow their brains out. Do you understand me? I'm everywhere now because you ball bags can't get enough quaint jar action. I'm in the Acropolis kicking over vases. I'm in China slapping terracotta warriors. I'm in the British Museum on the Rosetta Stone because I've got an all-access pass to everywhere and I'm blitzed out of my skull. I'm the high priest of eternity. Hey, don't get me wrong. I know you'll walk away from mason jars eventually. One of these days, you turncoat will be done with your mason jar snow globes and spice planters. You'll move on to vintage soda bottles or pewter beer steins or whatever other tranny container gets you for a while. But until you do, we'll go right on porn stars 5 at a time on the 160th floor of the Burj Khalifa. Put a picture of that on your little Pinterest page under cute wedding ideas. And when we at Ball Mason Jars finally go down, we're doing it like the Vikings wish they did. But guess what? I've also got investments in wall hangings, vaulted candles, wicker wreaths, and 100 other types of wholesome crafts that you brain-dead little should seat right up. The other guys at my company might be content to slip back into obscurity once mason jars are over, but not me. I'm not about to walk away from my new life. I'm everything. I'm the world. I'm the last, and I'm going to keep burning and burning and burning until I'm a crispy corpse or you finally get tired of DIY furnishings, which will be never. Now go make some wind chimes out of mason jar lens. I want another island.
Thank you, Luisa Martinez. To the rest of you, April Fools, just a couple of days early. Still to come, Matt Witt's review of 2 recent Western novels by women, and extensively about women, and my own reflections on Rosa Luxemburg. Speaking of whom, there have been several music groups named after her, groups from Catalonia, Japan, France, and elsewhere. We're playing the music of the French group this morning. Their first album is called Rosa Luxemburg and is divided into chapters. Chapter 1, Revolutions, has 8 songs telling Rosa's story. Chapter 2, with 4 additional songs, is called Advance Toward Tomorrow. Here's a little more of their music. Now Matt Witt reviews Alibi Creek by Bev McGinnis and The Music of Bees by Eileen Garvin. Matt calls his review How to Manage a Crisis and asks what you, our listeners, do when facing a crisis in your personal life or your community. Do you deal with things on your own, or are you able to find sources of support, and are you open to them? The women in these novels learned and changed.
There's a saying that the personal is political, and that's certainly true in two enjoyable novels about women in small Western towns. One of the books is called The Music of Bees, and the other is called Alibi Creek. In both stories, the main character is a woman who has to overcome a crisis in her personal life, and in the process gains the strength to challenge injustice she has long tolerated in the community where she lives. The Music of Bees takes place in Hood River County, home to long-established farms and orchards, newly arrived windsurfers, and a total population of about 24,000 from all across the political spectrum. The author, Eileen Garvin, knows the local people well and has a talent for showing us what is in their hearts and minds. Alice, the main character, has deep roots in that community and is an administrator in the county planning department, a secure job with good benefits, as long as she doesn't rock the boat. She also has become a beekeeper on the side and is learning about the complex communities that bees create. But at 44, Alice has become increasingly depressed and socially isolated since the sudden death of her husband in a highway accident. Through a series of coincidences, Alice meets two other lost souls, an 18-year-old boy who is permanently confined to a wheelchair after falling from a balcony at a drunken party, and a 24-year-old wanderer who suffers from severe social anxiety. The two young men go to work for her, helping her expand her beekeeping operation. And as the three of them become more engrossed in the bees' world, they become a makeshift family and take turns helping each other gain new confidence and openness to human connection. Which is lucky, because Alice needs all the strength she can find when she discovers that county officials and a major pesticide company are involved in a corrupt scheme that threatens the health of local bees. The threat to the environment has drawn the attention of local community organizers. Will Alice join them and in the process put her job and future retirement security at risk? In a different novel with a strong sense of place, Alibi Creek by Bev McGinnis, another woman in her 40s is facing her own crisis. Leanne also is a county administrator in a remote rural county in New Mexico. She too has kept her job for 20 years by going along with whatever the Republican county commissioners want. Her bosses steer construction contracts and county jobs to their relatives, and she does the paperwork to cover for them without saying a word of protest. She lives outside town on her family's ranch with her husband, two grown sons, and her aging mother. All is well at home until Leanne's younger brother comes home from prison, determined to get rich quick with a new criminal scheme. Leanne is a devout Christian who quotes Bible verses to herself about forgiveness and who believes that whatever happens is part of God's plan. But her refusal to set boundaries for her brother drives her husband away. "You're stuck in your faith," he tells her, thinking it makes you strong, but it's like quicksand pulling you under. As she realizes she will have to stand up to her brother, Leanne also has to decide whether to put her own job in jeopardy by exposing the county commissioners who are planning to plunder huge new federal grants meant to help low-income women and children. And ultimately, she has to consider whether she can just rely on faith to make things right or whether it takes action by her and others in her community. "If God sees all and is just," she asks her mother, "I can't understand why some are favored and some are forgiven, some are lucky and others are cursed." In both Alibi Creek and The Music of Bees, the main characters start out trying to deal with personal and political problems on their own. Along the way, both of them learn that they need friends and family and community to make the changes they want, both for themselves and for the towns where they live. For both Leanne and Alice, the personal is political, and it takes a village to make progress on both.
Thank you, Matt Witt. I've been teasing you all through the program with references to Rosa Luxemburg. It's time now to confront her directly in our regular feature, Another World is Possible. The voice you hear, other than my own, will be Luxemburg's, mediated, of course, through the dulcet tones of Patricia Kohlberg. Rosa?
Those who do not move do not notice their chains. Rosa Luxemburg.
We recently celebrated the birthday of a great revolutionary. At least I did, and I hope you did too. I like to think that one of the reasons March is Women's History Month is because this is the month Rosa Luxemburg was born. In honor of her 150th birthday, the Rosa Luxemburg Stiftung, the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, published a book of letters written now between pairs of correspondents around the world who've been influenced by Red Rosa. The book is called Post Rosa, Letters Against Barbarism. The subtitle comes from the famous Luxemburg quote,
"As things stand today, capitalist civilization cannot continue. We must either move forward into socialism or fall back into barbarism."
I'll return to that quote later in assessing its relevance to us now. Needless to say, Rosa Luxemburg is not around to join us in celebration. She was murdered more than 100 years ago by right-wing thugs hired and directed by the German Social Democratic Party, of which she had been a member, and which had just come to power after World War I. With their vision of managing life on behalf of workers, they felt threatened by a movement of workers to manage things on their own behalf, a movement of which Luxemburg was a part. It's easy to commemorate people who've made great contributions, in her case, both in theory and activist practice. But how do we evaluate the relevance for us of someone who lived in a different time and context? Luxemburg was a small woman with a limp. She was Polish when Poland was part of the vast Russian Empire, and Jewish when that empire hosted anti-Semitic massacres. In all those respects, gender, physical ability, nationality, religion, she was an outsider. Being an outsider, as we've talked about here on Another World is Possible, for instance, when we've discussed queer, black science fiction, being an outsider can provide insights into the system you're forced to see from the outside. In fact, a key element in developing a reality-based understanding, a truly radical consciousness, is the necessity of divorcing ourselves as much as we can from what passes for common sense in the status quo, turning ourselves into outsiders, divorcing ourselves from commercial entertainment, learning to critically examine media messages and analyses, recognizing the very different potential that underlies the sordid reality of our society, and using that potential as a standard against which to measure the actually existing world around us.
The most revolutionary act is, and forever remains, to say loudly what is.
Writing to the editor of that book of contemporary letters I mentioned, one of the correspondents said something I like. Here's what he wrote. "It is often said that the history of a book or work of art is the history of its interpretation. The same can be said for the life of a person. Rosa Luxemburg's life and works have been interpreted in a variety of ways over the decades. What explains these differing views? Surely, that each generation draws out dimensions of her work based on the problems of their own time. So what problem faces our time that offers a vantage point for exploring her legacy anew? As I see it, two issues stand out. One is the utter failure of all socialist and communist regimes to lead to a transcendence of capitalism. The other is recognition of the thoroughly racialized nature of contemporary capitalism. These are the problems facing our era, and we cannot expect Luxemburg to answer them, but we can ask what her work means in light of them. That was from a letter by Peter Hudis, himself a distinguished editor of and commentator on Luxemburg's works. For me, her murder is a starting point for evaluating Luxemburg's continuing relevance, because it highlights a split, a bottom-line difference, in what people, mistakenly I think, call the left. For some small part of that left, all through the 20th century and into the present, the aim of politics has been to encourage and equip ordinary people to run the society. In other words, to develop worker capacity toward a genuine democracy, extending from family life through the workplace to the institutions we create for coordinating resources and social policies. The so-called socialist and communist regimes talked some of that talk, but postponed the actual effort to the indefinite future. This was the basis on which Luxemburg was critical of the Russian Revolution, and all the more so of her former comrades in German social democracy. Her stance in favor of workers' democracy was seen as so threatening that they assassinated her.
Some believe that if their number grows mechanically and automatically, that this in itself is progress. They forget that quantity has to transform itself into quality.
Even in leaving the Social Democratic Party, Luxemburg knew that an organization was necessary in order to learn and transmit the lessons that come out of struggle, and to consolidate the gains of victorious reforms. She also recognized that organizations have a tendency to become bureaucracies, to stagnate tactically, and to create little centers of power, little fiefdoms, within their upper ranks. Her own correspondence, hundreds of pages of which I've read this past week, share her complaints and frustrations. This is the dilemma of organizations, a dilemma which we continue to experience. In fact, she was convinced that competing revolutionary organizations could be a good idea, and criticized Lenin for banning other groups and consolidating all control within his one Bolshevik party.
The remedy which Trotsky and Lenin have found, the elimination of democracy as such, is worse than the disease it is supposed to cure. For it stops up the very living source from which alone can come the correction of all the innate shortcomings of social institutions. That source is the active, untrammeled, energetic political life of the broadest masses of the people.
Toward that end, the active, untrammeled, energetic political life of the broadest masses of the people, Rosa Luxemburg combined theory and practice. She taught classes, spoke at conferences, participated in strikes, and agitated in the streets. She also wrote books and pamphlets, making important contributions to how we understand what drives capitalism and to how imperialism works. She was an early theorist of globalization and combined her theorizing with compassion and activism in international solidarity work. She's been criticized from the standpoint of identity politics for not devoting herself more exclusively to women's issues or the plight of Jews or Polish national self-determination. Instead, she linked each of those sets of issues to their underlying social-economic structure, capitalism, and approached each of them through her anti-capitalist understanding.
The poor victims on the rubber plantations in Putumayo, the Africans with whose bodies the Europeans play a game of catch, are near to me. I am at home wherever in the world there are clouds, birds, and human tears.
The time in which Luxembourg lived was, of course, very different from our own, but it too was bleak, with World War I, with the betrayal by the socialist parties that had sworn internationalism, but then supported the militarism, country after country, of their national governments, with the intimations of approaching fascism. Luxembourg's correspondence is full of advice to her comrades on how to maintain their spirits, how to continue the struggle.
To be a human being means to joyfully toss your entire life on the giant scales of fate, if it must be so, and at the same time to rejoice in the brightness of every day and the beauty of every cloud.
That's the second time she's mentioned clouds. Luxembourg spent years in prison for her beliefs, for acting on her beliefs, and her consolations were what she could see from her cell and from the prison yard. Whether in prison or amid organizational struggle, she insisted on maintaining her humanity through appreciation of nature and all forms of art. Writing from prison, here's how she scolded one friend.
That you now have neither time nor interest for anything except the single issue, namely politics, is calamitous. For such one-sidedness also clouds one's political judgment. And above all, one must live as a full person at all times.
So where do we stand today on that alternative she posed us, either moving forward into socialism or falling back into barbarism? How do you assess our prospects now? What is it reasonable for us to aim at?
Socialism is not a question of the knife and the fork, but of a cultural movement and a great and proud worldview.
However barbaric the times, that is our goal here at the Old Mole. This has been Norm Diamond with another episode of Another World is Possible. Let's leave the last word to Rosa.
Long live the revolution. Keep your spirits up and be joyful, or I'll be seriously cross with you.
And that's today's Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks to Old Moles Bill Resnick, Luisa Martinez, Matt Witt, Patricia Culber, and John Nelson, and guest Emery Mort. Listen to the Old Mole next and every Monday morning. Meanwhile, remember the words and wisdom of Rosa Luxemburg. Stay safe and stay active.